I'm Dee Mae Roberts, stage and studio. We're listening to a song by Vijay Iyer from the album Human Nature. You can find out more about him at vijayiyer.com. May is Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, and events are heating up all over Portland. First up, we'll talk with playwright Nandita Shenoy, whose play Washer Dryer gets its stage reading and Oregon premiere by Theater Diaspora, with performances on May 14th at 7 p.m. and May 20th at 2 p.m. at Portland Center Stage at the Armory. Nandita Shenoy wrote Washer Dryer to create more real-life, ethnically diverse roles, especially for South Asian American actors. We'll hear about her play and about her work as a playwright and actress in New York. Then veteran performing artist and activist Chizao Hata joins us live to tell us about two important events in May to remember Japanese American internment, which is the 75th anniversary of Executive Order 9066, and Portland's Japanese community who experienced the Vanport flood. Stay with us. This is Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts. Actress and playwright Nandita Shenoy was tired of auditioning solely for roles with accents and decided to write a genuinely funny comedy about love and family. Her play, Washer Dryer, is a romantic comedy with a diverse cast, especially including KBOO's own Sarika Mehta and actor Anthony Lam as a newlywed couple trying to keep their rent-controlled apartment in New York. I talked with Nandita Shenoy via Skype and asked her if writing a romantic comedy was a way to break out of expectations that plays of color had to be heavy dramas.
Yeah, no, I agree. I do feel there was a period of time where most of the Asian American plays I was seeing were very sad or sort of morose and very identity based. And I think there's definitely, you know, a place for all those kinds of stories, but at the same time, I don't feel like my life is particularly sad or morose, even though sometimes it's really aggravating. And also, I particularly feel that Asians don't get to, to be funny without making fun of themselves, without being the butt of the joke. And I don't think Asianness is particularly funny, but I think Asian people can be really funny. I think Asian Americans have funny lives. And it was really important to me to have two romantic leads who were both Asian, who were different kinds of Asian, to experience that kind of mixing and intermingling, so that kind of the romance was not in perspective to whiteness, because I think also we can be fetishized, especially the women. Asian American women are often fetishized, and so it was just important to me just present a different view of Asian Americans in the theater that I don't think we see, but I hope mirrors what many of our lives are like, and that we are Americans and we are living everyday lives and have the same kind of problems that other people that you see on TV and on stage do, which is that we are looking for love, we are trying to make a home, we are trying to negotiate our families, and we're just trying to live and have a nice time. So that's what inspired me to write a play.
All very good reasons. I want to talk more about your play, but let's talk about maybe, you know, your background more, about when you first started, you know, before you started getting the idea to write this play. You're a working actress.
I am.
Tell me about your experience, especially regarding casting, and have you always lived in New York City?
I have lived my entire adult life in New York City. Yeah, I started in the business as a dancer. I worked in musical theater for a long time. I did a lot of King and I. And as I branched out into being a straight actor, I found the roles that were there for me were very limited. And my particular issue at that particular time was that I didn't ever audition with my own accent. I always auditioned with an Indian accent, and I found that very frustrating. And one of my friends, one day after we did some reading of a play that no one really liked. I was just like, oh, I can't believe this. And my friend said, you know, don't you have an English degree? And why don't you write a play? And I was like, yeah, why don't I? So that's kind of what got me on this track. And yeah, so I like writing Asian American characters who have American accents.
And it was very important for you to write an Asian American play without an accent. So, especially for this play, I think that says a lot.
Play, but then there is a character who does have an accent. I mean, there are different levels of Asian Americanness. You know, there are people, there are the immigrants, and then there are their children, and then there are their children's children, and you know, and obviously for some groups of Asian Americans, there's even deeper history than that in this country. For me as a South Asian person, most of my South Asian friends are first generation and most of our parents are immigrants. So, I think that's a particular experience, but I don't think it is weird or unusual. And I also have lots of white friends whose parents are immigrants, and I have some white friends who are immigrants themselves. So, I think that there's a lot in the experience that can relate to many different cultures. And then I think there are some things that are very particular to being a South Asian person who grew up with immigrant parents at this particular time in history. So,
do you find, you mentioned that you were auditioning for a lot of plays or doing plays with accents, but do you find that there's more open casting now? Are there what's the landscape now in New York City for Asian American actors?
I mean, I think it's definitely changed a lot since I started writing about 10 years ago. That the experience of auditioning with an Indian accent exclusively is no longer my experience. I think it's also that there's a whole generation of Asian American writers who are coming of age and being produced now that makes a big difference as well. So it definitely has changed. It's definitely gotten better. But at the same time, there are there's still issues of whitewashing and there are still issues of yellowface. We still talk about these things. So I think there's still a lot of work to be done. I think there's a lot of room to grow. And I think there are many, many more stories out there to be heard and be shared.
Well, you mentioned your motivation for writing Washer Dryer. Was this your first play? You said you started writing 10 years ago, so this must not be your first play.
This is not my first play. I wrote my very first play was a short play, and that was produced in a bunch of places, first in New York, and then a bunch of places around the country, and then I've written Washer Dryer was my fourth or fifth full length play.
Was the role of Sonia basically for you to play?
When I wrote it, I hadn't had that in particularly in mind, but I do tend, I'm learning to acknowledge the fact that I always have a Nandita character in all of my plays. So Sonia is definitely the Nandita character, and I did get to play her in New York, which is really wonderful and amazing. I feel like if I'm not writing parts for myself, who else is going to?
So how often have you been able to play Sonia?
Just once. I played it off Broadway. I was happy. I was also happy. The world premiere of the show was in LA at East West Players. And it was really an amazing experience for me also to have that kind of production and to be able to solely be the playwright and not be doing double duty. So I really appreciated that opportunity as well. It's always a joy, no matter what, to have your play produced. So that's really great.
So is Sonia a little autobiographical?
I mean, I would say so. And some of my friends would be like, that's exactly you. The real inspiration for the play was a specific incident in my life involving my apartment. My apartment is not a studio, and I do not have a washer dryer. So there's a little bit of wish fulfillment going on in my play as well.
You wrote it because you want a washer dryer. I mean, is that why you added that? Because it would be like, this golden apple, to have that.
Well, I mean, I put the washer dryer in the apartment because it is the just the holy grail of New York real estate. I mean, my experience of writing the play and telling people about outside of New York would be like, oh, that sounds cute. And anybody in New York would say, oh, you cannot let go of the washer dryer. Like, dead serious. You know, and this cut across all racial and socioeconomic lines. Like, anyone in New York who has a washer dryer is not giving up that apartment.
So that's actually realistic. Even though it's comedy, it's realistic.
That's why it's funny.
And it rings true for a lot of people, even outside of New York, I think. Once you have something that's affordable, you know, because housing is, you know, not very affordable for a lot of people. But once you get something that you can afford, you know, you want to hang on to it.
And there's always that thing. I mean, you know, that thing that people want in their home, whatever it is. In this play, it's the washer dryer. But when I watched HGTV, which has sadly taken over my life, you know, I watched these couples talking about, you know, I must have a laundry room, or, you know, I can't live without a mudroom, or if we don't have double sinks in the master, we'll kill each other. I mean, there's always something. And I think that that's, you know, a part of kind of the American dream, is having your home that is the way that you want it. And this American myth of having it all, I think, especially for women. So there is this, you know, status symbol of how a washer dryer means whatever it means in New York. I'm sure in other parts of the country, it can be having an attached garage, or I don't know what, but there are, you know, however many bedrooms you have or whatever it is. And people are very attached, and it is a lot of money. If you buy real estate, unless you're just like fabulously wealthy, it is a deeply personal and huge decision.
Are you happy with your home now?
I'm very happy in my home now. I've always been happy in my home, but I also think that New York real estate is so crazy. You know, there doesn't need to be, I definitely manipulated rules and, you know, gave this, you know, fictional co-op, you know, a set of very specific rules. But in New York, co-ops can really have any rules that they want. So it's just not that far from the truth. But my apartment, I do live in a co-op, but my apartment is not single occupancy. So.
Oh, yeah, thank goodness.
So I don't have to sneak anybody in here.
So I was wondering, you mentioned some of the reactions you got to Sonia, the character in Washer Dryer. But have you gotten any, you know, I mean, what are some, I guess, some of the surprising reactions that you've gotten for your play Washer Dryer?
I mean, I don't know that it was a surprise, but people really responded to the monologue. And what was surprising to me is how many men responded to the monologue.
Can you tell our listeners what that monologue is?
Yeah, Sonia's monologue at the end of the play, which is about what the apartment actually means to her, you know, as a single woman, what she had to go through in order to buy this particular apartment, and so why she doesn't want to give it up. And so I expected it to be resonant for a lot of women who, you know, I have a lot of female friends who have actually purchased apartments, and the process of going through that whole process is awful, and particularly awful for single women. But more than that, one of my friends, a male actor, came and told me he just cried after in that monologue, because talks about, you know, how hard you work as an actor to just kind of make it. And if you put enough money together from whatever, you know, gig, whatever that golden gig is that gives you enough money to make a down payment on an apartment, just how meaningful that is and what that says that you as an actor have achieved and what it represents. And it really was moving to me when he told me that, because sometimes I feel like, oh, you know, is it just being frivolous to care so much about a thing? But especially in our business as actors, we are so, you know, we are living so tentatively so much of the time. So to have something as solid and significant as a home, it is meaningful. And a lot of people really, really, you know, connected to that in a way that was surprising and touching to me.
Beautifully put. I was wondering if you are working on your next plays. I'm sure you are. So is there anything that you can tell us about your next project?
Well, I managed to write two new full lengths after Washer Dryer closed off Broadway last year. So I'm in the process of, you know, putting those out into the world and seeing what might happen. And I'm currently working on a commission for Flux Theater Company, which is a theater company here in New York. I'm working on a kind of noir mystery for many women, trying to subvert the noir genre to be a more female-oriented form, if I can. So that's my big task that I'm trying to achieve, and hopefully we'll have some good progress to report soon.
Well, my ears just perked up when you said noir for women. I love that. So I'm looking forward to that. I want to follow that, see how that's going. Is there anything that else you want to say about, are you doing any acting? What's your next role?
I don't know what my next role will be. I am auditioning, as I just had an audition before this call, in fact. I did a play earlier this year in February, a new play. I was in it with, actually, Flux Theater produced it, a new play by Adam Simkowitz called Marian or The True Tale of Robin Hood, which was a gender-bending version of Robin Hood. And that actually is going to be published. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah, that sounds fun too. I've got a question here, and if you don't feel comfortable answering that, that's fine with me. I just heard that Young Jean Lee is having her first, is going to be the first API playwright on Broadway with her play Straight White Men. And so I don't know anything about it. I mean, kudos to her, definitely. But I'm wondering about, like, the pressure, if you feel any pressure or, I don't know, impetus or motivation to write roles that are not API. I'm just wondering, especially from an actor's perspective, I'm wondering how you feel about that.
I mean, for the same reason that I'm, you know, coming to terms with the fact that I always end up writing parts for myself. I move in the Asian American theater community quite freely and quite often. And I have so many friends who are such wonderful actors. If I'm not writing for them, who is writing for them? I mean, you know, I feel the impetus quite the opposite, that I need to write for my community.
Yeah, I feel the same way too.
I don't know. I don't think that I can sit here and say, I want to write in order. I'm going to write whatever it takes to get on Broadway, because who knows what it takes to get on Broadway. And I mean, to take the obvious example, like Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote for his, you know, first show about his neighborhood that was not about white people, and then came up with the idea to dramatize Alexander Hamilton's life and, you know, with people of color. And who would have thought, like, that's your ticket to Broadway? So, you know, I just feel the impetus to write, A, what I know, and B, for the people that I know who don't get the opportunities that, you know, I also have a lot of wonderful white actor friends, and, you know, and some of them are in my plays too. Frankly, my personal life is diverse, so that's what I want to see reflected on the stage, and that's what I write about. So that's my two cents on that.
I think it's been a topic probably for the last decade or so, because a lot of writers of color, you know, feel, you know, this kind of conflict. You know, you want to write whatever you want to write about. And some people might feel limited, and some people might feel, you know, the call to, you know, the mission to provide more roles for actors of color. So I think it's a personal choice, but it definitely is something that I hate to say it, but perhaps a white writer doesn't have to think about.
I mean, I don't think that necessarily white writers are asked to think about it. So I would love to see an interview with a white writer that, you know, someone asked them, well, do you feel compelled to write for white people? I don't know what the answer to that question is. I feel compelled to write for Asian Americans in particular, because I know, just looking at the stats that AIPAC puts out every year, the Asian American Performers Action Coalition, that we are not being hired at the same rate that other ethnic groups are. So let me try to create an opportunity for people who I know are tremendously talented.
That was actress and playwright Nandita Shenoy talking with me via Skype. Theatre Diaspora presents her play Washer Dryer on May 14th at 7 p.m. with the Playwright Talkback and May 20th at 2 p.m. with a panel on affordable housing. Both shows are at Portland Center Stage at the Armory. For more info and tickets, visit pcs.org or theaterdiaspora.org. Up next, we talk with Portland activist, actor, and dancer Chizao Hata. We're listening to music by Ozzie Catani from his album Remembrance, and you can hear more about Ozzie Catani at ozziecatani.com. And I thought Remembrance, his album, was appropriate because we're going to be talking with Chizao Hata. This is Stage and Studio. I'm Dime Roberts. She's a veteran performing artist. Chizao, are you there?
I am. Hi, Dime.
Hey, you. You've got two major events happening during Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, otherwise known as May. The first is Return in Remembrance on May 6th. That's coming up to honor those who were unjustly incarcerated by Executive Order 9066. And I guess it's the 75th anniversary of that. That was in January, right?
The executive order was issued in February.
That's what I thought. It was either January or February. During World War II. And it's at 2 p.m., the piece that you're doing, Return in Remembrance, at Portland Expo Center, where Japanese Americans were rounded up and housed before being imprisoned. Can you tell us a little bit, just, you know, we don't have a ton of time, but about this event?
Return in Remembrance is an event that's being held at the Expo Center, which was formerly the Portland Livestock Arena.
Right.
And when the Japanese and Japanese Americans were sent away from Japantown, also known as Nihonmachi, they were housed at the Expo Center for about 5 to 6 months while the internment or prison camps were being built, in particularly for the Portland people in Minidoka, Idaho. And so on Saturday, we're going to remember and return, which is the name of the event, Return in Remembrance, from 2 to 4 at the Expo Center. We've invited some wonderful speakers. There'll be a performance by the Minidoka Swing Band. There'll be exhibits on display. I have created a project called Remember Us, and it's a community engagement project where we've asked people to remember the almost 4,000 names and of people who were held at the Portland Expo Center. Everyone was given a tag and a number, and we reproduced those to hold them on a 30-foot-long rope, and we'll be carrying that in at the end of the event.
Oh, it sounds like a beautiful project there. Kudos to you for doing all of this, because I know that this is all, you know, basically from your heart, you know, your labor of love, because, you know, your family was touched by this. You have this history within your family.
Yes, my mother and father were actually married in a camp, not in Heart Mountain or Minidoka, but in Poston, Arizona. And this, you know, it's because it's the 75th year, and things are rising up again in ways that we haven't seen for almost 50 years of racism and racial language and hate speech. And so,
and talks about exclusion too.
Exclusion.
And I could talk to you forever about this, but another event I want to talk briefly about is the Vanport Mosaic Festival. You're doing a reading of a new performance piece you wrote with Nikki Nojima Lewis, the playwright, and you want to tell us about that?
Well, I'm really excited about that. It's called Gambatte, Be Strong, which in Japanese means, you know, hang in there, persevere. And it's really the American story of Portland, Oregon, and the Japanese Americans. And we can't really talk about Vanport without talking about Japantown, which is where we were forced to live, and then being forced to the Assembly Center, which is the event we just talked about, while the camps were being built. After the camps were built, we spent 4 to 5 years at Heart Mountain or Minidoka, Portland people, and then went to Vanport, and then were flooded out. So we were basically displaced in our history from 1942 until 1948, four times.
So Gambate Be Strong, Stories of Japanese American Displacement and Resilience in Portland. Just briefly, what will you be covering within that? All of the history you just mentioned, I suppose, and how will you be telling that story?
Well, I'm going to be trying to cover a lot of ground in a short amount of time, because this is the first year that I've attempted this piece. And I have six actors that I'm bringing on, a lot of photographs, some music of the era, but really a lot of the stories are based in oral histories of people that I've been talking to who survived Vanport and still are living in Portland. So that's been a very interesting process.
And people don't know about the flood. That was 1948, and it just wiped out a whole section of town, especially the African-American and the Japanese-Americans who were working at the and living in the, I guess, what it was called Vanport, but it's no longer there.
Right, yeah, the entire city. It's the second largest city in Oregon, which is about 30,000. People at its height to build ships for the war effort. And by the time the Japanese and Japanese Americans got there in 1947 or 46, when they were released from camp, there was only about 15,000 remaining there.
Well, two great events, Return in Remembrance, a pilgrimage to the Portland Assembly Center this Saturday, May 6th, 2 to 4 p.m. at the Portland Expo Center, Exhibit Hall A, located at 2060 North Marine Drive. It's free, but RSVPs are recommended to Oregon Nikkei Endowment. You can find out more at Oregon Nikkei, that's NIKKEI.org. Gambate Be Strong, Stories of Japanese American Displacement and Resilience in Portland by Chizel Hata and Nikki Nojima Lewis is part of Vanport Mosaic Festival, May 26th through the 29th. Two public performances, Saturday, May 27th, 2 p.m., Sunday, May 28th, 7 p.m. at the IFCC Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center, located at 5340 North Interstate Avenue in Portland. More info at vanportmosaic.org. Chizao Hata, kudos to you for all your work. You are Gambate. You are strong. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Dimei.
You take care.
Okay, you too.
That's it for Stage and Studio. I'll have this show online later today at stageandstudio.org, as well as on iTunes. Like us on facebook.com/stage, the letter S, Stage and Studio, the letter N Studio. And tweet me at Stage, the letter N Studio. Until next time, I'm Dimei Roberts. We're going to go out with more music by Ozzie Katani from his album Remembrance at ozzykatani.com.